It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. The historic protests that began in Cuba on July 11th were the largest seen in the country in decades. Multiple generations of Cubans took to the streets by the thousands all across the island nation, chanting homeland and life. But these demonstrations were interrupted by mass arrests from Cuban authorities. In the days and weeks since the beginning of the protests, some organizations have estimated that anywhere from 500 to 700 protesters have been arrested and detained. Here to talk more about what's happening in Cuba is Patrick Ottman, CNN international correspondent and Havana bureau chief. Welcome back to the show, Patrick.
Thank you so much.
So let's just start with what is happening on the ground right now.
Well, right now, there have been, of course, the protests, which the government put troops and police into the streets to stop. And for the most part, that was successful. They also cut off the internet for several days. And now we've entered a phase after they've had these mass arrests, gone house by house in certain neighborhoods where people are being put on trial and not surprisingly being convicted and giving months and in some cases years. In some cases, for filming protests, for being on the street when the protest took place. Other protesters who actually fought with police, Cuban officials say, will face much longer jail sentences.
Is this kind of repression something new?
No, you know, it's something that activists here have complained about for many, many years. We haven't seen it on this scale, though, perhaps ever in Cuba, where you have hundreds of people being arrested, hundreds of people facing trial, and not just police on the street, but special forces troops, people who are heavily armed, look like they are, frankly, an invading army, not the usual police that we see here, but the shock troops, the most highly trained elite troops they have, and they are currently out in force to prevent further protests from taking place.
When you are talking with people there in Cuba, what are they telling you or talking, you know, amongst each other about in terms of what were the sort of causal factors for these protests?
So the first protests that we're aware of, because they happen across this island in a way that has never happened here before, where you had literally every city and every town, people out protesting that first Sunday, July 11th. And the first one was in a town called San Antonio de los Baños, which is about 40 minutes from where I am now. And people there were experiencing something that's common in Cuba and very frustrating, which is power outages. And they tell me that they had gone about 6 days of having power cut off throughout much of the day. And it's hot in Cuba and people get frustrated. Their food spoils in the fridge, which is a big, big problem when food is already so scarce. And so something new happened, which is people got online, they connected, which is a recent phenomenon here, having data on your mobile cell phones, and they went on and protested, and they streamed it live. The Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, rushed there. Security forces tried to regain control, but by that point, already protests were breaking out pretty much everywhere in the island, and then here in Havana, where I am, where thousands of people poured into the streets and really voiced their anger at the government in a way that many people have never been able to do so before, have never dared to do so before here.
What do you think emboldened people in this moment?
It's just desperation, I think, because the pandemic has hit everywhere so hard, but particularly Cuba, which is dependent on tourism and has been basically shut off from tourism throughout the pandemic. There are increased sanctions were initiated under the Trump administration that have carried over during the Biden administration that, of course, have a big impact and tend to hit people perhaps on the bottom of society here more than people on the top who seem to be doing okay despite the increased sanctions. Remittances were cut off, and that's a very important lifeline, the ability for Cuban exiles in the U.S. to send money here to relatives. And that's how a lot of people eat. And then the government's own mishandling of the Cuban economy. Every supermarket is state-owned here, and it takes hours usually to get into one, waiting in line. Hundreds of people every day waiting in line to go and buy what there is, which increasingly is not very much.
So if these are causes, what are the desired outcomes? What are the goals?
It's really tough to say. That's what makes this so fascinating, is because while there is a small opposition here that the government is really works very hard to keep from having much of an impact, they didn't organize these protests. No one called for these protests. These were spontaneous. The Cuban government says that they were planned by the U.S. and that this is a plot hatched by the U.S. But the people I talked to in the street, they really just were regular people who were frustrated, felt they had nothing left to lose. And, you know, you talked about Patria Vida. This is a song that's went viral here several months ago. And it's really about how the revolution is essentially over and that something new has to happen. And a lot of people really couldn't put into words what it is they want, but they know they don't want what they have now, which is a very difficult life, a life where they can't meet their basic needs. And they feel that if they complain about the single party communist government, that they are not allowed to, that they're not allowed to go into the street and protest. So I think people want to have more of a voice and they want to have a normal life where they can feed themselves and their families. That life isn't such a constant struggle, which is a refrain you hear in Cuba every day, la lucha, the struggle. And that is what Cuba lives have been for a long time, but increasingly during the pandemic, during the economic failures of the last year or so, it has become harder and harder to become Cuban, to be Cuban.
It's interesting to hear you cite La Lucha, the struggle, because that always has felt to me as though it's had sort of multiple layers of meaning, both that it is a struggle and people would prefer to struggle less, but also that there's a certain kind of pride in that capacity to be in that struggle. Is that the thing that has fallen away in the context of the sort of COVID-19 economic crisis?
Very much so. I've lived here for 9 years and it's never been easy. Not for me, because I've much more advantages, but for Cubans to just meet, you know, just get through the day to find milk, to get eggs, you know, that's La Lucha. And people used to laugh about it because it was so ridiculous and they had to be so creative. People aren't laughing about it anymore. You know, something I've noticed living here is because of the pandemic, I might go weeks without seeing a Cuban friend or someone I've known for years. And when I see them again, they're thinner. People are thinner. And, you know, that's something that's new here, that people are not getting enough to eat. They're really struggling. And they're worried that the economy here could collapse, that simply that things cannot go on as they have been. And that sense of pride and the sense of we have to be more clever than the government to get around all the restrictions, that's really fallen away to a new grim reality.
Talk to me about the intergenerational nature of these protests. Who are the young people who we're seeing in the streets?
Well, these are people that did not grow up with Fidel Castro as kind of being the voice that was always on TV or the radio. You know, Fidel Castro got sick in 2006 and then really disappeared from the scene. So when they talk about the revolution, it's a very different revolution. They are young people that are often very frustrated that up until recently didn't have internet access. They didn't have the ability to get the jobs they wanted. Most people still work for the state in this country and they do not earn a living wage. And that really bears down on people, because how do you make up the difference? For a lot of people, it's family from abroad sending you money. For a lot of people, it's leaving Cuba, which most people don't want to do, but increasingly want to do. That's one thing that I hear again and again, is that people want to leave. And so for young people now, particularly during lockdown, and Cuba's been on lockdown throughout the pandemic, when there's nowhere to go, when the beach is closed, when there's a 9 p.m. curfew, the few pleasures and joys that they perhaps had in their life that made everything else okay or acceptable are not there anymore. And they're increasingly frustrated that they feel that their government is standing in the way of a better future.
So Cuban society is, of course, not a monolith. And we've talked a little bit there about generation. Also help us think a bit about race. How have issues of race and of even of sort of economic privilege, to the extent that there is there are those differences, how have that played in here?
I think a lot of people watching these protests have been surprised to see the number of Afro-Cubans taking place. And of course, the revolution, one of the great claims of the revolution is that it was fighting racism and leveling the playing field. One thing that Black Cubans that I know say again and again is that the police, perhaps like in the U.S., treat them differently and are much more likely to pull them over, stop, ask for their ID, identity cards, which you have to have on you at all time here, and harass them more. And I think that's why you saw so much anger, particularly among African Cubans, directed at the police and actually, in some cases, people threw rocks at police cars and overturned police cars. So, you know, the song Patria Vida is a reggaeton song. There's a lot of anger in that song. One of the refrains is, it's over. And when you go into the poor neighborhoods, which is where the protests really turned into riots here, there is a simmering anger. People feel that they've been passed over, not just by their government, but also by the people who can get ahead here that have relatives in the United States who are predominantly lighter-skinned Cubans. And they get, or up until recently, they received remittances. And that allows them to do much more and live in a way that most Cubans simply cannot. So when you go into the poor neighborhoods that are supposed to be the strongholds of the Revolution, you actually find a lot of anti-government sentiment.
Now, let's come back stateside for a moment. How is the Biden administration viewed at this point, sort of from the perspective of the Cuban protesters? And is there something in particular that they would like to see the U.S. government do in response?
You know, it's that's the big question, is what can the U.S. government do? So far, the Biden administration has placed more sanctions, which is something that has not worked in 60 years. I know talking to people here, they want to have more contact with the U.S. They want to have more openness with the U.S. They want to have more opportunity. And they feel that closing Cuba off only helps the government.
Patrick Ottman is a CNN international correspondent and the Havana bureau chief. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised.
Now, according to this classic piece by Gil Scott-Heron, the revolution will not be televised. But ever since the Arab Spring of 2013 and the Ferguson protests of 2014, it's been pretty clear that social media is going to play an important role in future uprisings and protests, which is undoubtedly why some governments have begun using communications blackouts as a tool of repression, and why some innovators are responding with censorship circumvention software. With me now to discuss one of these products with a very hard to say name, censorship circumvention software, is Keith McManaman, who is a strategic analyst at Siphon. So, Keith, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Keith, talk to us about Siphon and how it's operating right now in Cuba.
Well, as you mentioned, at Siphon, we work on what's called censorship circumvention technology, which refers to essentially a variety of techniques that can be used for anti-censorship online. So in a large and growing number of countries in the world, access to information is restricted. And in fact, it can be restricted down to a highly granular level. For example, individual websites, domains containing specific keywords, or even particular types of or entire categories of web traffic. As we saw in the Cuban context, the government responded to the protests by blocking access to social media, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and messaging applications like WhatsApp, Telegram, and Signal. So Siphon technology is effective at bypassing this type of filtering. You run a simple-to-use app on your device that routes your connection through a server in one of a few dozen open internet regions around the world, and establish an encrypted tunnel through which you securely run your web browser, your applications, and all the traffic from your device. Basically, circumventing censorship with Siphon involves appearing to the censor that you're someone else, somewhere else, or looking for something other than you're looking for.
So I got to say, as you're describing it sort of towards the end there, I'm thinking, okay, I get how that works in a way that makes us, you know, maybe want to cheer if you're talking about moving around the censorship of a repressive government. But that also sounds like it could have some nefarious purposes as well.
We tend to not be concerned with what specifically users are accessing. We don't know that information. We don't basically, like, if you treat the internet as a resource of, a sort of global resource of information as one kind of integral object, then, what goes on between you and your internet connection is sort of the user's own prerogative.
So how is this technology different than, for example, the VPN technology that has been used in Nigeria to kind of move around the Twitter ban that the government imposed?
So in the Cuban example, internet measurement researchers determined that the Cuban sensors were blocking the messaging apps through something called a TCP reset packet that was injected during the TLS handshake. So a simplified explanation of that is that encrypted connections taking place over the internet, they do require part of that transaction to happen in the clear. So I'm communicating with some server somewhere. I say, I want to set up an encrypted connection with it. It says, that sounds good to me. What kind of encryption do you want to do? So the sensors or the ISP can basically launch an attack by inserting a fake, so these reset packets have a functional purpose in web traffic. So in normal circumstances, it would be used to inform one of the two parties that there's a problem in the communication and that connection should stop. So an adversary can inject one of these packets that basically disrupts the connection from ever happening and cause that connection to terminate. So, we heard that within Cuba, VPN connections were also blocked in the same manner. So VPNs can have anti-censorship properties, but the vast majority are designed for normal network conditions and would be susceptible to those kind of disruptions. When we're talking about a circumvention tool like Siphon, it's designed to basically resist attempts to directly interfere with our network traffic or our connections from being established. And the way that it does that is by essentially obfuscating the nature of the traffic. It's using transport protocols that are difficult to detect or emulate many of the most common types of web traffic to basically be indistinguishable from random bytes on the internet.
So my understanding is that at the peak, there were about 1.4 million Cubans making use of the internet through this technology. How did they find it? How did people know to make use of this circumvention technology?
Word of mouth is often a key driver of circumvention tool adoption. In a place like Cuba, where there's relatively low levels of digital literacy, word of mouth is a key factor in terms of people finding out what tools are working. In this case, there were the landscape of tools that could be effective on those networks was extremely restricted. Siphon was one of the only things that was keeping people online. And internet users will be resourceful and resilient in these kind of situations. They will find ways to, you know, maintain communications with each other and maintain access to information. So, this is a phenomenon that that we've definitely seen before. Obviously, the adoption of circumvention tools in this context was completely unprecedented. But now that we've seen basically like a population scale deployment of circumvention tools there, people will be ready for future internet disruptions.
Keith McMenamin is strategic analyst at Siphon and making me feel a little bit like I'm in a spy movie today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. On Tuesday, testimony began before the Congressional Select Committee convened to investigate the violent mob attack on the U.S. Capitol January 6. The committee heard from four law enforcement officers on duty that day. One is Private First Class Harry Dunn of the Capitol Police. And warning here, folks, because it is quite shocking, you're going to hear some hard language, including the N-word, in this testimony. But don't turn away. Listen.
More and more insurrectionists were pouring into the area by the speaker's lobby near the rotunda, and some wearing MAGA hats and shirts that said Trump 2020. I told them to just leave the Capitol, and in response they yelled, "No, man, this is our house. President Trump invited us here. We're here to stop the steal. Joe Biden is not the president. Nobody voted for Joe Biden." I'm a law enforcement officer, and I do my best to keep politics out of my job. But in this circumstance, I responded, "Well, I voted for Joe Biden. Does my vote not count? Am I nobody?" That prompted a torrent of racial epithets. One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, "You hear that, guys? This nigger voted for Joe Biden." Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, "Boo, nigger." No one had ever, ever called me a nigger while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer.
There is hard history at the core of Officer Dunn's testimony.
And that's when it hit me that the library in which James Madison conceives and conceptualizes the Bill of Rights rests on a foundation of bricks made by the children that he enslaved. And this is hard history.
That's the voice of Hassan Kwame Jeffries, professor of history at The Ohio State University. And you just heard a portion of his TED Talk about confronting hard histories. Hard histories were woven into every line of Officer Dunn's testimony. Hard history. The rioters refused to leave because they claimed the Capitol as their house. But who has a right to lay claim to the Capitol? Construction of the U.S. Capitol began in 1793 with enslaved Black people who were rented out as laborers. Their skills profited their enslavers, but they were never paid for their labor. Still, they're responsible for raising the Capitol at every stage from design to construction. Hard history. Officer Dunn recalls asking insurrectionists attempting to nullify the election if they considered him to be nobody. It is, in many ways, the same question Dred Scott asked in 1857 when he petitioned the Supreme Court for his freedom. The response came from Justice Roger Taney, delivered in the court's opinion. He wrote,
"The question before us is whether the class of persons described in the plea, people of African ancestry, compose a portion of this people and are constituent members of this sovereignty. We think they are not, and that they are not included, and were not intended to be included under the word citizens in the Constitution, and can therefore claim none of the rights and privileges which that instrument provides for and secures to citizens of the United States."
So to the court, Dred Scott was indeed nobody. Hard history. Officer Dunn asked the mob if his vote even counted, but Black men's votes did not count in 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, when another armed mob of white insurrectionists murdered dozens of Black men, destroyed Black property, drove thousands of citizens from their home, and overthrew the democratically elected city government. A hard history told in the 2016 film, Wilmington on Fire.
"It had to be done," said the white people who started it. "They loved their town until the Blacks tried to change it. They took over the city to restore their heritage, they said. They were heroes to many who wanted uppity folks dead.
Hard history. Officer Dunn is clearly pained about being called a racial slur while wearing his Capitol Police uniform, but history suggests it's the uniform itself that may have raised the ire of the mob. In the decades following the Civil War and after both World Wars, Black veterans wearing their uniforms in public were uniquely vulnerable to white supremacist hostility, mob violence, and lynching. For much of our shared history, a Black man, even one in uniform, even one prepared to give his life to protect democracy, was nobody. His vote did not count, and he had no home in the Capitol.
And this is hard history.
As I watched, the question I kept asking is this: are we ready to begin a new chapter in our history?
Everything is different, but nothing has changed. Why is telling the truth hard? I guess in this America, it is.
We turn to you, our listeners. We wanted to know if you watched or heard the hearing and how you were feeling. Your response was overwhelming. In your gratitude for what the officers did.
My name is Chris from Quilcene, Washington. I thought the testimony was very compelling. My heart went out to the officers who testified, to the members of Congress, and to all who are affected, which is all of us. I feel a great deal of gratitude to the people who saved the day at the Capitol.
In your empathy for what they experienced.
This is Nancy in Berkeley, California. I did not think I could get any more shocked by the events of January 6th. I was so impressed by the officers who testified, by their dedication to safeguarding Congress and the democratic process. And they were so articulate and honest, and boy, were they mad.
This is Linda from Vancouver, Washington. I cried when I heard the racist slurs that Officer Harry Dunn had directed at him and other officers, as well as listening to all the officers detail their injuries and subsequent trauma. Everyone must be held accountable, including the former president who incited the violence. It's unacceptable to have something like this happen.
In your anger and concern over the state of our democracy.
My reaction was anger towards the insurrectionists, fear about the possible loss of our democracy, and disgust with the Republicans who have lost all reason and the ability to engage in critical thinking. Mark Kelmanson, Keystone Heights, Florida.
This is Jeremy Larson from Dallas, Texas. I am stunned that lawmakers from the right aren't being more forceful about this tyranny. It is a danger to our democracy, regardless from which side it comes.
My name is John. I'm calling from West Palm Beach. My reaction is that it's hard to believe. Even though we all saw what happened on January 6th, so many of elected officials, they want this country to be an autocratic country. It's so treasonous.
This is Peter from Novato, California. This morning I was curious and read the opening remarks of the two conservative Republicans on the committee. I thought they struck the right tone of patriotism and realism about the events of the day. This is their time to shine. I hope they can keep their heads up under the withering pressure they must be facing. My hats are off to them.
I was quite emotional when they spoke about being more afraid at the Capitol than they had been in Iraq. So it was very touching and meaningful. And I think this is the very crux of what we're facing now in America. This is Keith from Dallas.
And in your definition of the attack.
My name is Paul Shaughnessy. The officer's testimonies, really, it brought tears to my eyes and my wife's too. We're both veterans. And I tell you, what happened to those gentlemen and almost happened to our country is criminal. They call them terrorists, and that is a very good description of the people that did this. Being former military, we would call them domestic terrorists.
My hope is that the testimony today will have some legal repercussions that will expel people from Congress and hold other people accountable, maybe bring some people to jail for inciting this, terrorist attack.
Hi, I'm Alejandro from Denton, and I was really happy during the hearing to hear the officers refer to the mob as terrorists, which is exactly what they are. It's a great way to make everybody realize the difference in the justice systems that exist in America.
My name is Sharice, and I'm calling from Hollywood, Florida. I listened to Tuesday's testimonies from members of the Capitol Police Force, and I found their statements to be not only compelling, but chilling and very disturbing. They need to all be held in the highest esteem for their efforts in dealing with the terrorists who stormed the Capitol. And yes, I believe them to be terrorists.
Thanks to everyone who called in and who texted. We value your insights, and we always want to hear from you. The number to call is 877-869-8253. Or send a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. This is The Takeaway.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
We're listening here to President Richard Nixon declaring the war on drugs. But what did that mean? Where were the front lines? Who was the enemy? And how would we know if we were winning or losing? Well, a little evidence comes actually from just 5 years ago, back in 2016, when Beyoncé's husband, also known as Jay-Z, offered an answer to some of those questions in a narrated video created in partnership with the Drug Policy Alliance.
In 1986, when I was coming of age, Ronald Reagan doubled down on the war on drugs that had been started by Richard Nixon in 1971. Drugs were bad, fried your brain. And drug dealers were monsters, the sole reason neighborhoods and major cities were failing. No one wanted to talk about Reaganomics and the ending of social safety nets, the defunding of schools and the loss of jobs in cities across America.
You see, Jay is actually the ideal ambassador for this message, because President Richard Nixon's drug war is the older sibling of hip-hop, born just 2 years before that famous Sedgwick Avenue house party. Like hip-hop, public policy needs rhetorical strategy. And even as Black Americans in the late 60s were pressing for full citizenship in the Civil Rights Revolution, lawmakers were stepping into the cipher to test cultural deviance as a battle strategy for public opinion. Citing drugs and communal pathology, these lawmakers shifted public attention away from structural inequities and toward a new monster, drugs and drug users. Now, if the goal of the war on drugs has been to spend trillions and incarcerate millions, then we are right on track. But given that more than 93,000 people died of drug overdose in the U.S. last year alone, if the war on drugs has been to eliminate or reduce drug use, then
the war on drugs is an epic fail.
Joining me now is Aaron Morrison, national race and ethnicity writer at the Associated Press. Aaron, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's good to be with you.
So 1971, where did this policy come from? Why did Nixon declare this war on drugs?
Well, he saw it as a way to go after the quote unquote hippies and Black activists that were not only standing up against the Vietnam War, but were continuing to assert their rights and fight for their liberation.
I think one of the things I'm most stunned by looking at this history is how quickly there were suggestions basically from all policy sectors to decriminalize, at a minimum, to decriminalize marijuana. Like by 1973, you've got government entities, you've got researchers saying, well, marijuana should certainly not be Schedule One. So why did that not happen 50 years ago?
That's because there was a political advantage for Nixon and some of his successors to really demonize the use of drugs as a proxy for getting at those folks who were pushing for progress and change across the country. So that's all it took, because at the same time that drugs were being used more recreationally, more so marijuana, you also saw increases in violent crime. They were starting to prop up in urban areas. So that was, an easy scapegoat. It's like, well, if we get the drugs out of these communities, we can decrease the violence. However, we know today that it was a lot more complicated than that.
Right. Just because there's a correlation, simply because there is drug use and crime is rising, does not mean that there's a causation. It's not necessarily the case that drug use caused, right, an increase in crime.
Absolutely. But, it's an easy message, especially when you've got the media willing to play that game as well.
All right, so let's dig in on the media part a bit. I appreciated the piece that Jay did back in 2016 and all of the work that the Drug Policy Alliance has been doing now for a decade. But I also wonder about the ways that sometimes the narrative is almost exclusively male. And having grown up right in the same era as a young Black woman, I'm always thinking about Kemba Smith, about all of the Black women who also got caught up in the sort of criminalization net of the drug war. Talk to me a little bit about how media hysteria impacted both Black men and Black women.
Well, I mean, let's just be clear. I mean, it was easy back then to paint the picture of particularly young Black men and Latino men as the public enemy number one in their communities because of the uptick in violence in the 1980s. I mean, between 1984 and 1989, the crack cocaine was associated with a doubling of homicides of Black males aged 14 to 17. So that meant that the communities, at the same time that they were experiencing pain and hurt from the violence they were seeing, they were also crying out for a solution. And another point on that is Black women perhaps were the most impacted, because not only were they seeing their sons and fathers and uncles and brothers dying or going to jail, they were also being left home to care for the family in the wake of the sort of drug sweeps and the violence. At the same time that Black women were also incarcerated at higher rates than white and Latino women, they were also shouldering the burden of being left behind a lot of their men went away.
So let's, there'd be nothing that sort of the partisan aspect of my brain and heart would like to do than to put it all on Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and call this all a blame game on Republicans. But that would be not only unfair, but also inaccurate. Can you talk about how Democrats and Republicans have been pretty bipartisan, and even the Congressional Black Caucus, in sort of aggressively pursuing this war on drugs for decades?
For the piece that I did for the Associated Press about the drug war, I spoke to Cassandra Friedrich of the Drug Policy Alliance, and she made a point to me that I felt was really, really important. She said that if you were a Black leader in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, back then you were searching and grabbing for any solution to not only reduce the violence that you were seeing in your community, but also the huge addiction problem that you were seeing in the community. So it's that context that in which we have to think about the support for drug war policies back in the 1980s. However, Black folks said, please come, help us clean up our communities. Please come help us with addiction. They didn't say lock up all of our people. They didn't say come in with a heavy hand of law enforcement and don't provide any of those resources to help us deal with the addiction problem.
Now, as we look at this moment and ideally moving forward to address some of the damage that the war on drugs has done, particularly in communities of color, again, there is actually some bipartisan work happening here, some sense that folks acknowledge the many ways that this has been bad for the country. Can you talk a little bit about some of those bipartisan solutions that are at least beginning to emerge?
Well, today you see much more bipartisan support for decriminalization of drugs. That's different than legalization of recreational use of drugs. But decriminalization has gained a lot of support, and it's because what we've seen with the opioid crisis is that there are now many more white people addicted to drugs, to painkillers, to other things that you can buy on the street. So if you set up an entire apparatus and infrastructure for criminalizing and incarcerating people who are addicted to drugs and those who also sell or traffic those drugs, the current drug crisis, which we know to be around opioids, that means many more white people are going to be incarcerated than others. So I think that's also part of why we're seeing a push for decriminalization, because we can see a difference in who is most impacted, you know, when it comes to our public health crisis in drugs.
How did the war on drugs impact voting and voting opportunities, even as we're seeing them now 50 years later?
Well, I mean, we're talking about in certain states, because, you know, at the same time there was a federal, you know, prohibition on drugs, states mirrored those policies in their own legislatures. So in certain cases, if you had a drug offense on your record, that affected your access or housing, or, you know, if you're fighting for child custody rights, you know, the courts and the agencies can see your criminal record. It also, you know, a lot of states implemented felony disenfranchisement, which meant that, you know, as a result of your felony conviction, you could not get your voting rights back unless you paid the fines and fees or restitution associated with your conviction. And then also, I mean, it precluded a lot of folks with drug offenses from gaining their drug rights back. And you know, I should be clear here that, you know, people do regain their voting rights. They do get their gun rights back, but you've got to have the know-how and sometimes even the money to hire a lawyer to help you seal or expunge your record.
Not only voting, but this kind of tie between war on drugs and criminalization and the incarceration system, how also might that, or, you know, as you reported, has it affected housing, education, and work opportunities?
So in the story, I featured a man by the name of Alton Lucas. In the 1980s, he became addicted to crack cocaine, and he was also trafficking in it for a short amount of time. You know, his life could have gone on two different paths. He was either going to go to, you know, to college to play basketball, or he was going to go on the road with his friend, a famous DJ known as DJ Nabs, to go and you know, tour around the world. And you know, they were performing with a lot of artists from the So-So Def record label. And so he found drugs instead. And so he went to prison for drug-related crimes, came out and got treatment and early release, actually, as a result, something that a lot of people didn't get at the time. So Mr. Lucas, he, you know, has been, at to this point, nearly 30 years clean. So 30 years sober, has not been in trouble again. But today, he still cannot pass most criminal background checks because he still has a searchable felony conviction on his record. And that means when he's trying to apply for any jobs, there that could be a question about whether or not they hire him. The same with business loans that can also be a hindrance for him. So, that, yeah, I mean, when we're talking about the ripple effects of the war on drugs and what is happening to people, sometimes they have a lifelong consequence from something that happened 30 or even 40 years ago.
I'm wondering if there is a really kind of entirely different way to think about this. I had a conversation with Carl Hart back earlier this summer, and he wrote the book Drug Use for Grownups. And he's basically like, legalize all of it. Like, what are we talking about here, people? That the opioid, overdose crisis is, for example, has more to do with people having to use it illegally, we use language like crack and heroin, and people just immediately think it's just all horrifying. And what if we just backed all the way up 50 years, 1971, and just didn't declare a war on drugs, like any more than we would declare a war on sugar or alcohol or cigarettes? In your reporting, in talking even in these communities most impacted, is there any taste, any desire for that level of legalization and kind of moving back?
There is definitely support for decriminalization and legalization of recreational use of all drugs, illicit drugs. However, addiction prevention advocates say that that could also be disastrous because at a time where people need to be continuing their development, typically in their teenage years and in their early 20s, the introduction of drugs can throw a lot of people off. It's not to say that it's a lifelong, sort of fail. You would fail at life if you try drugs in your teens and 20s. Addiction prevention experts say, look, let's pump the brakes on just blanket legalization of these drugs. If that does not also come with resources to help people who become addicted, but also resources to educate the public about what drugs can do to you, because there are things that the public should know about the use of drugs and what it does to your body. There's the science behind it.
Aaron Morrison is the national race and ethnicity writer at the Associated Press and apparently an advocate for science, knowledge, data, and information. Who knew? Thank you so much for joining us, Aaron.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, y'all, that's the show. Have a great rest of your day. And look, if you live in a state where weed is now legal and you're into that kind of thing, feel free to smoke it up and relax. Call us with your show ideas, your stories that you want to share, and your suggestions for us. Use 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.